We can't go home. We can't keep running. What are we supposed to do?
I'm gonna fight. I'm gonna fight. Now, this is easier for me because I'm used to it. The rest of you are gonna have a tougher choice. And look, I don't want to sell it to you. It's too ugly for that. And it's ugly and it's hard. But when you're fighting in your own backyard, and you're fighting for your family, it all hurts a little less and it makes a little more sense. And for them, this is just some place. But for us, this is our home. Now, obviously, we don't stand a chance against these guys in a straight-up fight. If you look at the Viet Cong, or the Mujahideen, or even the Minutemen, it's clear. Even the tiniest flea can drive your big dog crazy. So the first thing we have to do is learn how to work together. Become a unit. And that's gonna take some time. It doesn't take much to pull a trigger. But keeping your shit together in a firefight is a whole different story. So we're gonna have to evolve. Rewire our reflexes. Learn new skills and adapt old ones. There's almost 500,000 faces down there and they can't track them all. So we'll find people we can trust. Friends with their ears to the ground who can help us get the things we need to fight back. We'll watch what they do. Study their tactics, their routines. The more we know, the easier it will be to hurt them. But we'll need to be smart, and we'll need to be patient. We'll hit them on our terms, when we're good and ready. We inherited our freedom. Now it's up to all of us to fight for it.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and making landfall with me today is Trish Coughlin.
Hey, everybody. Wolverines!
Sam Stepanenko.
It's me, as usual. Maybe, sort of. I could be somebody else.
And Jeff Omega.
They'll only take my gun if they pry it from my cold, dead hand. Oh.
What, they chop it off?
Dead.
Well, we've had a few requests, and this one comes from Instagram, I think, Jeff, right?
Yes, we got this request from Esten Ramirez, who loves the podcast and loves Red Dawn.
Yes, I know Esten. He's also interacted with us on Facebook. So this request is for Esten, and if you want to make your requests or fan challenges, email us, invasiontheremake@gmail.com, and it could be a future episode, just like this week's episode, Red Dawn, the classic modern war film from 1984, which was remade again in 2012. This is my first foray. This is one of those 80s movies that people talked about that I actually never watched until just now. Well,
same,
a day or two
same.
Ago. Same for everybody? Yeah.
Oh, no, I've seen it lots of times, but not in a long time.
Okay. And Trish, you have too?
I have too. I've seen it. It was rented on VHS, but I haven't watched it in a very long time.
It was very different than my memory served me, I'll be honest. I remembered it having a lot more action in it and a lot less drama.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty action-y, but the problem is, like, there's so much violence in this PG-13 movie, you get desensitized to it after a while, which maybe is the point that John Milius is trying to do, but I actually thought it was about half hour too damn long, and there's a lot of shit already on the cutting room floor from this movie, from my understanding.
Yeah. What I forgot about this movie is what's funny when you talk about all this action and get desensitized by the end of it, it's very long for how much action, but how it starts so quickly. I thought there was more lead in, like, oh, it's like 5 minutes and then the Russians are there.
It's unrelenting. You're like, okay, well, I guess we're not going to get a chance to meet anybody. And you really don't. You don't really in the remake either. So they just thrust you right into the invasion.
Yeah, I loved that, though. I think it probably is one of my favorite openings to, like, any movie like this. It was just like a lot of the things that the characters were going through, especially in the first half an hour of the movie, is stuff that, like, the audience is also swept up in. And there's like the confusion and what's going on. And all the questions that you have is also what the characters are going through. And it was a really strong setup for a movie, I thought.
Yeah, I thought this was one of the stronger openings to a movie. Unfortunately, it has the trouble keeping that same pace. But I think there's strong characters throughout the film. I can see why it garnered a cult following after a while. Like, this isn't... Like, people talked about this in the 80s when I was a kid. But I wouldn't say it was like one of the most revered 80s movies either. It was, I think, one of those ones that just left an impression once you see it. And I can see why.
Yeah, it's definitely a product of its time. Like, this is right near the end of the Red Scare, as it were, right? Where everyone was still worried about the Russians invading North America. Right?
Yeah, it'd be what, 6-7 years before when the Soviet Union was disillusioned or.
When the wall came down.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years, yeah, because it came down in 1989 and this was 1984.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was right near the end of that. And they did a great job of capitalizing on that. And also sort of what was happening in the world at the time. A lot of people were really worried about Reaganomics and the economies of the world economies. And I mean, they at the beginning, they even talk about how the UN has been dissolved. They set it up really nicely. So they don't tell you when this is actually happening though.
It's about 1989. If this movie was made in 1984, it was about 5 years later from the stuff I was reading. It's never stated per se, but it's about 1989 as far as its presentation goes. Now, I mean, this is an alternate universe timeline thing. Honestly, this kind of siege on the United States is damn near impossible, even in 84, because when you think about the Russians, the U.S. has got two massive oceans on either side. So we got to the Atlantic Pacific Ocean already. And what usually starts wars is what another nation needs. So, I mean, Russia generally doesn't want to invade the U.S. because it's too damn far away and everything that they need, they'll just invade elsewhere, closer to home. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. And Cuba just wouldn't have the resources.
You're looking at it from, like, why would Russia do this? Yeah. This is an American's perspective is less. They'll definitely come invade us because they just wander all over the place all the fucking time. So they don't understand why other places wouldn't do it.
And the only country capable of doing it is the U.S.
And I mean, to be fair, John Milius is a pretty big history and war buff and other stuff. And I think that obviously, if it could have happened, it probably would have happened. But in terms of a what-if scenario, I feel like it's not as outlandish as a lot of people make it out to be. I feel like they covered their, especially in the first one, they covered their bases pretty well with trying to establish plausibility in it happening. I mean, Russia invades other countries all the time. Even within the past several years, they, you know, invaded the Ukraine.
Well, that's kind of my point. Yeah. They don't have the capability to bring all that equipment and stuff over the ocean. Mm-hmm. They have a pretty good navy, nothing compared to what the U.S. has.
Yeah.
And nobody touches the U.S. as far as the air domination goes. Nobody. Mm-hmm. Not in 84, not now.
And so, they're not going that far.
No. So, I mean, as far as realism goes, it's not possible. I mean, yes, Russia has a great army that's capable of a lot of things, but they think locally, domestically, they're not really set up to do that kind of war.
Yeah. Do you think that at the time it was plausible enough that, you know, at some undisclosed time in the future, like, I think because it takes place in a sort of near future and with the UN dissolving and everything else, I could maybe see the poles shifting enough to suddenly, you know, cause a windfall for a country like Russia.
But the technological shortfalls, right? That's the big deal.
And the pointlessness of it. Mm-hmm. Because as you're saying, like, see, the Americans will go all around the world in case someplace might be communist. But the Russians don't give that much of a shit about that. They never really did.
It's more like with the states. Like, the Russia has a lot of land mass, but it would definitely be because of stuff like food production and factory, like factories set up within the states that they could use to generate resources. And then
again, they would go with the Ukraine. They would go into Europe. It just makes more sense. Yeah. I mean, they want Italy in that because they want wine. and booze. So, I don't really think, like, it's just too much effort for what they're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
I think the one thing this does hit on, which was that fear of World War III, and they do make mention of it, whereas nuclear weapons were shot. Mm-hmm. Like, nuclear weapons have taken out major portions of the U.S. And that was something that I think a lot of people were scared of. I mean,
yeah.
Nuclear war, when I was a kid, it was huge. It was like quicksand. I was very scared of that and quicksand.
Well, thank you, old Tarzan movies, for that. We know how I feel about quicksand.
Yeah. And Fantasy Island. It happened a lot in 80s TV shows. Quicksand showed up a lot.
Yes. And it still haunts me today. It's like, God damn it, this would not happen. There's no. Yep. Every time it shows up in a movie, everybody knows we got to put it in on a t-shirt. Fuck quicksand.
Yeah. I think the invasion is not realistic, but shooting a nuclear weapon was more realistic.
But playing on the fears of the Red Scare during the Cold War, it certainly made sense. These alternate timeline movies are pretty rare as a whole. Like, we've seen Tarantino do it with Inglourious and Bastards, but I can't think of too many of these alternate timeline scenarios.
I actually really like this tiny subgenre of fiction where it's not science fiction, but it still takes place in the future. Like, right now I'm reading The Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, and that takes place in like the 2020s, but it deals with a lot of similar things where it's like, you know, in a handful of years, within the next 20, 30, 40 years, some stuff might shift in the world that you know, and then just cause life to be much harder and everything to be more about survival than you think about now. But it's not like post-apocalyptic, like Mad Max or The Road. It's like this little subgenre. I feel like Predator 2 also weirdly fits in this tiny subgenre where it's like, in a little bit of time in the future, global warming has caused everything to be really hot. And everyone has slightly more futuristic looking guns. And yes, it's kind of a neat little subgenre that Red Dawn, the original one, fits in. I think that was what was missing about the remake is it felt too contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think they said it's anywhere even in the near future. It was all present day. If they did, they certainly didn't go out of their way to tell us in that remake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seemed the original part of what I guess made it stick was that you're watching very young, like young looking actors, young kids be thrust into the situation. And the remake, everybody felt a little too old for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Adrian Palicki was supposed to be in high school. She's a few months older than Chris Hemsworth, who is off fighting in Iraq.
Yes.
Yeah, that was like, I actually really loved the original Red Dawn. I'm actually a pretty big fan of John Milius in general. Like, I seem to like his movies a bit more than the average person seems to. But I mean, this was a breakout movie for most of those young actors like Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen and Leah Thompson. And they all felt really young. But over the course of the movie, they felt like kids at the beginning of the movie. And by the end of the movie, they felt like they'd been really hardened by everything. And I feel like that's not an easy thing to accomplish.
Yeah. Well, between this and The Outsiders, this was like huge. Some of these people were just on a roll at this point.
Yeah, this was either a breakout or you had all these guys from The Outsiders. But, you know, John Milius, he's very much like everybody else. He has actors he likes working with. That's why we had in the 80s, we had a Brat Pack. And I can't say we have that now. Yeah. Movies like this, Young Guns, and they just, we don't get those movies anymore where this generation of young actors all come up together, all find success together, all find controversy together. and ultimately overcome.
I think the Disney Channel is the only place that's giving us that right now.
the last time where that really happened in any way was maybe the Harry Potter movies, but they didn't really do anything outside of that franchise. They were just in a lot of movies together and all came up together. But
yeah, they grew up together in those movies.
Movies like the new Hunger Games or all of like the YA novel type movies, like a lot of, you see a lot of similar faces, but yeah, nothing nearly to the level of the Brat Packs that we had in the 80s, which I kind of miss.
Well, let's get to the first trailer here for Red Dawn 1984, and we'll dive more into this.
This is the emergency broadcast system. We are under attack by conventional forces of the Russian army. It is believed the lead waves were disguised as commercial charter flights. Communications have broken down with other parts of the country. Large areas of the Midwest may have been overrun.
Who all of you are, they're looking for you.
You're 40 miles behind the enemy lines.
I just want to go home. They took a lot of people away.
Where's my dad, Mr. Tracker?
What if love somebody, Andy? I'm gonna die before it happens.
They're gonna kill us! All of us!
So why should we be different?
Because we live here!
Not bad for a bunch of kids, huh?
Mama'd be real proud.
That was Red Dawn from 1984 with the story screenplay by Kevin Reynolds, who wrote Waterworlds and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Couple of big late 80s, early 90s movies. Like huge.
Yeah. Well,
two huge disasters, too.
Robin Hood did pretty good.
Yeah, Waterworlds. Yeah, I like Waterworld, but I mean, it was very expensive movie and didn't wind up finding its return.
Yeah, his script was pretty heavily rewritten by John Milius, I was reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's also got a screenplay credit and as the director as well. I mean, we've talked about him in episode 40, Conan the Barbarian, as the writer and director. And he's also wrote Apocalypse Now and Dirty Harry. So I don't know. When you say you think you like more John Milius more than the average person, I think the average person likes him a lot.
See, you know, here's the thing. There's a lot of things that, like, so a lot of people talk about Conan the Barbarian as being pretty cheesy. I enjoy it pretty earnestly. And the same thing with this movie. I see a lot of people say Red Dawn is really cheesy, but I like authentically really enjoy it. And I mean, Dirty Harry is pretty big.
Conan the Destroyer is cheesy. Conan the Barbarian is a very cheesy. Honest and very much going for something.
You know, John Milius, I didn't realize this. He was pretty passed around as like a script doctor. And he wrote a lot of really famous monologues. Like he wrote Quint's monologue from Jaws about the USS Indianapolis. 1,100 men went into the water. 289 men came out of the water. Sharks took the rest. And all that stuff. Like he's really good at writing just impactful, you know, badass dialogue.
War's his jam. And if you got dialogue about a military thing, then chances are he might have something to do with it, especially in the 80s. All right, let's get down to the cast of this movie. This stars Patrick Swayze as Jed, and we talked about him way back in episode 36.
Point Break.
It was definitely Point Break. C. Thomas Howell, as I like to joke about him because I see his name pop up on anything now. I'm like, ah, and it always says, and C. Thomas Howell. I'm like, fuck me, because he's got so much garbage in his resume. But, you know, in his younger years, he was pretty hot. And we talked about C. Thomas Howell in episode 201.
The Hitcher?
That was The Hitcher, yes.
I got one.
You did. Leah Thompson was Erica, and we talked about, Sam and I specifically talked about her in episode 199.
Howard the Duck.
Woo!
Charlie Sheen makes his feature film debut in this movie, and we talked about him in, way back in episode 35.
The Wraith.
That was The Wraith. And Darren Dalton was Daryl, who was in The Outsiders. Jennifer Grey was Tony, and she was in Dirty Dancing, which may be why I kind of avoided this movie in the 80s, because I didn't want to see Dirty Dancing, and I just thought of Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey as those dancing actors.
And interesting fact is they didn't get along on this either.
No.
So yep. I do not know why they cast them together in Dirty Dancing.
The docu-series on Netflix, The Movies That Made Us, they dive into the reasons for that. And she was hesitant to do Dirty Dancing because of her experience on this movie, because Patrick Swayze wouldn't break character while he was on set, making life fairly miserable. But I mean, Leah Thompson loved working on this movie. So I guess it all depends on the type of personality you are.
And apparently John Milius, he was like, I'm the general, and Patrick Swayze, he's my lieutenant. So John Milius only directed Patrick Swayze and then told Patrick Swayze what he wanted from everyone else.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason why Jennifer Grey, like, she thought that was kind of bullshit. Yeah. That Patrick Swayze could boss her around.
But. And Swayze was like, maybe you should be telling the actors. He wasn't all that comfortable with having to do that either because he knew he was getting hated for it. And I mean, these poor actors did go through major boot camp. Dale Dye was behind the training. And if anybody's heard that name, Dale Dye, you've seen him in most of the military movies as some sort of general. And he's the military mastermind as well about how to train these troops and what is historically accurate, or at least for the military. Brad Savage was Danny. He was in Salem's Lot. Doug Toby was Aardvark, and he was in Summer Camp Nightmare.
That's a great title.
I thought so too. Ben Johnson was Mr. Mason, and we talked about him in episode 197. That's right.
And
I know there's an and I'm missing. I tried to
Mighty Joe Young.
He's
in the original Mighty Joe Young.
Yeah.
Wow. Episode 234.
Wow.
I knew he looked familiar.
Stretched back a ways. What episode was that?
Episode 234.
234, Mighty Joe Young. I can't believe we've only talked about Harry Dean Stanton once, but we talked about him in probably one of the more iconic roles in episode 131.
Repo Man, that was so much fun to remake.
It was.
I love him. It was actually a treat seeing him show up. He's like one of those 80s character actors that I'm always excited to see in a movie.
Right.
And you know, in rewatching this is another thing. I remember Harry Dean Stanton just being in it more, but I guess I totally misunderstood.
Yeah,
maybe he just casts a big shadow, but he's hardly in it.
Yeah, he's hardly in it, but yeah, you're right. His character does. I mean, he's the father of Jed and Matt, so his character does cast a big shadow, but you feel like he's in it more than he actually is. Ron O'Neill was Bella, who's in Superfly. William Smith was Strennikov, and was also in Conan the Barbarian. And Vladek Shabel was Bradchenko, and we talked about him in episode 155.
That one was a surprise to me, but yeah, it was Casino Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
The original, again.
Yeah. The late Powers Booth was Andy, and he's been in things like Sin City, The Avengers. He had a hell of a resume. Frank McCray was Mr. Teasdale. We talked about him in episode 178.
Last Action Hero.
Yeah, where is the police captain?
He was actually in the GIF I posted this week.
Oh, I missed it.
For a Throwback Thursday for Used Cars.
Oh, he was in Used Cars. That's right. Roy Jensen was Mr. Morn. And we've talked about Roy Jensen a lot. Episode 73.
Oh, you got me now. You went deeper than I did.
Okay, that was Paint Your Wagon. Episode 233, Every Which Way But Loose. And episode 240, 13 Ghosts.
Wow.
And I also wanted to mention Lane Smith. He plays Mayor Bates, the father of one of the sons. He's a fairly major character. He's also that person you saw in that thing that one time, including episode 75 when we talked about Network.
Yes. He's always that. He's that guy. When I saw him show up, I was like, oh, that guy.
Yeah. You know, I love seeing one of those guys.
There are a lot of them in this movie, actually.
The 80s was big for character actors.
When we were watching this movie yesterday, I was saying to Leah that there are some movies that come out in, you know, a bunch of years ago where almost every person who's in it goes on to do a lot of stuff. And it's just like this movie is so jam-packed with great actors who have been in a lot of really good things. It's kind of unreal.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. A lot of there's some bad things too. I mean, Jay mentioned C. Thomas Howell. Swayze yo-yoed quite a bit. He had a sort of a peak there, and then he went in to do things like Black Dog and other
not
great stuff. But I mean, that's sort of the career of an actor sometimes too, right? Is you get your breakout roles and then you maybe aren't as careful in checking and picking your roles for a while there, and you end up doing a lot of garbage. Look at Nicolas Cage for a while there too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for current almost, except for The History of Swear Words, which is amazing. Watch it. Or getting a nose job like poor Jennifer Grey. She looks great, but it just made her so, it changed her, just the look of her face just enough. It really, really wrangled her career.
I think she's had a strange nose at the start and end of her career.
I don't know. Her nose looks...
I don't understand that stuff.
It's a normal pretty nose, but I love the character of it.
Just be a good actor. I don't give a shit if you have a weird nose or not.
Right? Yeah, I think it was the whole thing where she got pressured, where it's like, you need to be prettier. But that nose was what made her so unique looking, and that was what was great about her.
Yeah, there's too many generic looking actors and actresses these days, so I always like it when you have somebody's a little more unconventional, and I hate even using that word because everybody looks the way they look, but if you keep casting like mannequins
yeah,
and that's one of the big differences between the two movies is when you watch the original, like they look like they've been living out in the woods for months. Their hair's matty and matted and they're dirty and they look just worn out.
Yeah, and you got supermodels in the remake.
Yeah, they always look like supermodels.
Yeah, perfect hair all the time. Yeah. Like Chris Hemsworth hair is always like, you know, perfectly gelled from that morning. They have clean fingernails.
Yes.
And why is their hair not getting longer after months of being in the woods? I can't imagine that they're going to have a lot of time for personal grooming, right? And they did that really well in the original because they all, like Leah Thompson in particular, if you look at her hair, it gets longer throughout the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it gets greasier. But the only thing I will say is, like, I know they're kids, but they're teenagers, so there's got to be some beardiness happening at some point.
Yes, and that was one of the things that I noticed in both, is none of them sort of got kind of scruffy looking in the face.
Yeah,
but for film, you want to be able to see their faces. I
think that's a credit to Milius. He always goes for something that looks accurate, and like, he went for all practical in this. There were no CGI enhancements. Not that there would have been back in the 84, but there's no matte screening or superimposing. Like that, those people being parachuted into this little town that they were shooting in. Mm-hmm. Those were all modified vehicles that sometimes got them in trouble. They actually had the CIA looking at their shoot and relieved that it was a movie shoot, because they would get a call that there is a Russian tank, and it was so convincing. They're like, how did you do this? Where did you get this? But they were very relieved when they found out it was just a movie shoot. But some of those paratroopers landed way far away from the set and looking like Russian paratroopers in 84 took some convincing.
Yeah.
And there's a thing that we actually thought, like, this placed what we were talking about much earlier, but apparently John Milius originally was trying to push for a longer production schedule on this movie so they could develop more futuristic type weaponry. And that was not something that they were really able to do. But apparently they did build a number of futuristic looking planes for the Russians to have, but they couldn't get the air clearance to fly them. So they didn't end up in the movie. But I guess there was an idea that, you know, like the Russians had technology more advanced than people were aware of. And that's partially why they were able to stage their invasion so successfully. But yeah, huge difference between the original and the remake. Like at the beginning, you can tell that it's real people parachuting down. And in the remake, you can tell that it's all CG'd.
Yeah, especially when those planes are blowing up and falling out of the air. I mean, it doesn't look terrible, but we've seen better.
But yeah, and when you talk about how the poor guys that end up very, very far from the set, I mean, it's partly to do with like those parachutes. They're actually using the realistic ones, whereas you're not getting the ones where you can actually figure out where you're going. Like those round ones, you can't really maneuver those. So it was realistic, but at the detriment of some of those poor guys.
There's just nothing that can compare with that like sense of dread and foreboding that is just permeant in the air, like looking outside a classroom and just seeing like hundreds of paratroopers. The atmosphere is very thick in the beginning of that movie, of people not knowing what's going on and all of this stuff happening. And there's none of that in the remake.
Yeah, no, they set up the tension really, really well, like right from the get-go. It's so well done, right up to the point where the innocence of the teacher, where he walks out thinking, not realizing, not even considering that they could be being invaded.
Yeah.
And ends up being the first casualty of that they witness.
Yeah. And they leave that one kid by the window. Like, it's shocking because that kid gets shot through the window and his body's just hanging off the counter. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty, I remember being really shocked by that when I was younger.
Yeah, this is crazy because this is one of the first movies to actually have a PG-13. I think there's one other movie that was shot before, but it came out after that was rated PG-13. So I think this is the first one to hit the theaters as a PG-13.
Yeah, it's it's a part of a trifecta of Temple of Doom and Gremlins.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the 84 where they really punched that rating and used it to full effect, but. Man, yeah, this movie's super violent. It's not gory, but you don't need it because it doesn't, despite not being gory, there's enough of the horrors of warfare here to get under your skin.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I just think that the balance of the drama, like showing the trauma these kids are going through with that action, just makes it that much more impactful. But you're also right, Jay. I think it's probably about 20 to 30 minutes too long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I had a question about it too, and I didn't notice this before because it didn't really occur to me when I was watching this as a young kid, but did anybody ever wonder why it was so easy for them to sneak in and out of town?
And they actually, that's one thing they did address in the remake, is they talk about how the population of the town they were invading was large enough that they wouldn't be able to recognize every single face. But yeah, they don't do a very good job of addressing that. And that might be something that was on the cutting room floor because it was already so long.
You know, I actually would be kind of interested in seeing a longer cut of the movie, just out of curiosity.
Well, some of the stuff that got cut, like, and you can see evidence of some of it. The romance between Tony and Jed is pretty much left on the cutting room floor in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's hints of it still left in. And even Erica and Power Booth's character, Andy, there was supposed to be more of that. At least you still get a sense of it, but it's pretty weak as far as that. And that's just something that pretty much was left on the cutting room floor, were relationships that budded during this horrible action that these characters were going through, that romances could still happen. They did try to put it into the remake, but I think they found the same problem, whereas there wasn't enough room, and having trimmed it down by almost half an hour, 25 minutes, made it feel really crowded when they did use it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really serve the rest of the story. I think it's important, but clearly they made the same decision. It's like, it's the least important part of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I found really funny was, again, a perspective change from when you grow up. I'm like, okay, like when I was a kid, the younger kids were, that was my crush. But watching this movie, I'm like, ooh, hello, Mr. Booth. How are you doing?
I will say that the infatuation with Leah Thomas's character with Powers Booth felt a little cringe as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think maybe that's why they pulled back on it too, is because there's a big age gap.
Yeah. And it was his response to it more than anything else. Her crush on him, it completely makes complete sense. It absolutely makes sense. It happens all the time. But his response to it was a little uncomfortable. I think that's maybe why the film was better served by keeping that to a minimum.
See, I sort of didn't mind some of it when she's trying to hit on him and he's like, tell me about your wife. Well, she's old like me. Like, he's trying to dissuade her, which I kind of appreciated.
Yeah, I think that there is, from what I was reading, one of the lines, like, they don't actually have a full-on love scene. They cut away, but there's a thing where Leah Thompson's like, oh, I've never been with somebody in that way before. Will you sleep with me before we die? Because we're going to die. And that's kind of how it was approached, which is, you know, I can see it. I can buy it. It not being there, you know, it's probably more welcome for some people as well.
Well, and her reaction, that's something I still appreciate about the original, is at times they still have teenage reactions. So when Power Booth dies and she's really melodramatic, I'll never love again, I'm like, yeah, that still feels like a teenage way to approach this.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Everything is the end of the world, literally everything. So what's interesting about this movie is like this extreme thing is happening to them. But yeah, you have these extreme reactions. But can you imagine when you're in this place in your life where everything is huge, but then something actually huge happens?
Yeah.
Your mind should explode.
Exactly. I mean, going through the transition to teenage to adulthood and all those hormones that are raging, and then everything's just apocalyptic when somebody doesn't call you or whatever. And then the apocalypse does come. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I actually really love movies that have like minority characters in kind of R-rated type settings and that are more coming of age stories, because for exactly that reason, like, that's a time where, you know, you just feel everything 10 times more than, you know, adults do. There's that one character where he was just in tears, like for the first half of the movie, he just couldn't handle anything that was happening. But all of that felt so authentic.
Yeah. And I really enjoyed C. Thomas Howell's character. I'm sorry, his name escapes me as usual.
Robert,
where he went from being sort of, I want to go home, to being like this really angry warrior. And he has one of the best lines in the movie where somebody asked him what it felt like to have killed somebody, and he's like, it felt good, because he was that angry, and he wanted his revenge that badly for the death of his parents. And I just really just enjoyed that whole arc for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. His character gets really dark.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he goes insane, and it's what really ends him at the end as well.
He also loves the people that he's with, and he makes that sacrifice to save Leah Thomas and the other character there, because he wants somebody to get it alive.
Oh, well, isn't that Charlie Sheen's character?
Yes.
Yeah, it's sort of those two get really used up. But yeah, it was sort of, there's the one thing that I found really interesting too, is you had that one character, like he's more emotionally stable, the one who eventually escapes with Leah Thompson. Like when it comes to processing his emotions, he's the most emotionally stable of everybody. And he's the one who kind of cries more, but he knows how to handle shit. He's going to survive this, like just emotionally, just as a human person, he's going to survive this better than anybody else.
Because he was the one where when they were driving away at the beginning, his father owned the gas station and they had to like hold him back while they were driving away.
Yeah.
That's something as well. Like the ending of this is pretty depressing. Like not too many, just two people out of this entire band of kids survives to the end of this movie. Not everybody we see the fate of, but if it's not out of the realm to think that they died. It's possible Jed might have made it out of there, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
he was already shot, and they were going to freeze to death on that bench.
Yeah, Matt dying in his arms. And I kind of liked that it had a down ending, but it still said, hey, you know, America prevails, and all wars end.
Well, and I like the fact that the invading guy, he has them dead to rights with his rifle, but he's like, fuck, I'm just tired.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because he was saying to the Russian commander that he used to be partisan and now he's just a police officer. And he was like not feeling comfortable with being an authoritarian figure over everybody else.
Yeah, you kind of had clear villains, but he was the one kind of in charge of the troops under these commanding officers that show up a little bit later. But you can tell he's very conflicted, and I kind of missed that character in the remake. You have like one moment with Captain Cho. There's like one moment where you can see it in the character, and one near the end when he lets them go. But you don't spend enough time with it. You really never get over the shoulder of any of the invading characters like you do in the original. Mm-hmm. So consequently, you're not peering in on the language. I think there's one scene with subtitles. That's it. Like, you almost never know what those characters are thinking or doing.
And I loved that. It actually, again, sort of built that sort of sense of alienation that these young people would have, because you don't understand what they're saying. You can't communicate with them. And when you're in combat with them and they're yelling at you in Russian and you're like, I don't know what you're saying. Right? And as a viewer, you're going, I don't know what you're saying, which is...
Yeah, I guess with the subtitles, that takes away the mystery. But at the same time, I do like a sympathetic villain where you can see that, you know, there is conflict there. They're not out and out bad guys, at least not everybody that's a part of this military action. And you can sympathize with them somewhat, which makes you care about it when them a little bit more when they do go
and
get blowed up.
This what kind of Red Dawn, the original, sort of goes into the whole contemplation is it doesn't matter which side you're on. It just burns up everything in your path. It burns up everything around you. It burns up you. It burns up all your resources. It's just kind of pointless. But the remake is kind of like, yeah, war is awesome.
And, you know, a lot of people say the original Red Dawn is like very pro-war, and like people say it's one of the most conservative movies ever made. But I didn't really get a super, super hoorah, war is awesome attitude from the original one. Like,
it gets pretty jingoistic at the end, in the ending narration, and very patriotic at that point. But
like, not overly.
For the most part, the movie, you don't see it too much. No.
I mean, I was saying to Leah, probably one of the biggest misfires of the remake is with the original one, you could take probably 80% of the original one and you could set it during World War II, and it could be a movie about a young band of like French resistance fighters against Nazi occupation. And it would largely be a similar story. It was very much just a war movie that takes place in the near future. But the remake like has no sense of that at all. With the original, even they end with the plaque of Partisan Rock, and then the credits have like these World War II style photos of all the kids. Really like brings that home, I think.
Yeah. And I think with the remake where they made Jed a military veteran undermined a lot of the heroism as well, because in the original, they were all just regular kids and who with some experience with guns because they live in a community where hunting.
You had outdoorsmen, and most of their tactics were informed by indigenous people, like the Native American and the way they would fight. And I thought that was really interesting.
And it wasn't just that, too, because they were kids. They're like, well, what did we learn in social studies? Which is how this movie kind of opens. They're like, OK, this is what they did in this war. So let's try that.
Yeah,
because that's what you would know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they didn't start learning even more military stuff until Powers Booth shows up because, you know, now we have this downed soldier.
It was hilarious, though, when they're like, what's a flank? What's rapid fire? Yeah. I was like, that's amazing.
Yeah. And there's that great line where he's like, I hate these kids.
Yeah. You know,
it was a nice bit of levity.
Yeah. He's hoping to get some help from this military group, the Wolverines. And it just turns out to be a bunch of teenagers that don't know anything. He's like, oh, no.
Very effective, though.
Yeah. And I do like that kind of stayed true in the remake somewhat. But when they brought in that, oh, we're after this little box that keeps their technology working when the MPs go off, I'm like, fuck, it's Ocean's 11 all over again with the garbage.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, like, honestly, the Red Dawn remake is everything I hate about modern Hollywood. And it's like, that movie could have been, it's like a best of McG movie moments in all of the worst ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they still peeled some of the better moments out of this movie, but it was really cut and paste and then falling into those horrible tropes that you know came from a producer who doesn't know how to fucking write.
Right.
And he's just like, well, I want this and I'm paying for it. Okay, we'll put it in. And it's garbage. It's so garbage. When they brought in, they like, oh, we're looking for this box because they have this EMP weapon that's knocking out our technology, but it's not knocking out theirs. We want to know why. Mm. I'm like, oh, fuck me. This is terrible.
Yeah, it has some of the worst dialogue, especially contrasted against like a pretty strong script in the original. Like watching them side by side really makes the remake very glaringly bad.
Yes.
I think now's the time to run the trailer for the remake so we can talk about where it goes wrong. We'll be right back after the trailer for Red Dawn 2012.
You're in the Air Force, right?
Marines, actually.
How long are you here for?
A few weeks.
30 seconds left. Just get us in field goal range.
22!
The blackout may run along the entire Northwest Corridor.
What's going on?
Get to the cabin.
Jake, you take care of your brother, you hear me?
Now go.
If you're seeing this broadcast, you are in a part of the country no longer controlled by the government of the United States.
Boys, I love you both, but I want you to do what I would do. Kill this piece of... No!
They mess with the wrong family.
How did this happen?
There's a new class of weapon. Everything went offline and never came back. They wipe us out, including U.S. Central Command.
What am I supposed to do?
I'm gonna fight. Anybody who wants to join is welcome to it. We'll hit them on our terms.
We're the Wolverines, and we create chaos.
We need to steal that weapon.
It'd be the foothold we need and take our homes back.
I can.
Yes, you can. Relax. And squeeze.
We inherited our freedom. Now it's up to all of us to fight for it. For them, this is just some place. For us, this is our home.
All right, that was the trailer for Red Dawn 2012, which actually sat on the shelf for 2 years, so maybe we should call it 2010. This was the screenplay by Carl Ellsworth, who wrote the remake for The Last House on the Left, Disturbia, and Red Eye. So some not bad stuff there, actually.
Yeah, what happened?
I know. And Jeremy Passmore, who wrote San Andreas, which I quite like as well. This was directed by stuntman Dan Bradley. It would be his only directorial outing. Maybe again someday, but it hasn't happened yet. He did stunts in a bunch of things we've talked about. We probably never talked about him in the episodes we've talked about, but he was the stunt coordinator in episode 8 when we talked about Trick or Treat. And then again, he did stunts in episode 65, which was House, and he was a stunt coordinator on Trancers, which we talked about in episode 218. This movie stars Chris Hemsworth, Thor. Yeah, he was there. Mm-hmm. He was definitely Thorish. If you listen really closely, you could tell he sometimes has trouble hiding his accent when he's doing an American one. But he ain't bad at it either. Mm-hmm. I'll give him that. When you're from another country trying to be an American, covering up your accent and then having to put in a good performance, you got to give him kudos for even trying to get even passable. I just hate it when somebody has to act through an accent and cover up their own, and it really hampers a performance. Isabel Lucas was Erica Martin, and she is one of Michael Bay's impossibly pretty girls that came from Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. Josh Hutcherson, who's actually a pretty good actor, was in the Hunger Games franchise, and he plays Robert. Josh Peck was Matt Eckert. He's more known as a voice actor, and you would, at least our modern audiences, would probably recognize him as Casey Jones from multiple Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles animation shows.
He's also more of like an indie film actor as well.
Yeah, and he had to really work hard, especially for that football scene. He trained with a college football team because he wasn't an athlete growing up. He had health issues that kept him from being an athlete. So that was a tough role for him, actually, for what amounted to 5 minutes on screen, maybe.
He was like a Nickelodeon darling. Like, he was a regular cast member of The Amanda Show, and he had his own sitcom for years and years called Drake and Josh that he was pretty well known for.
Adrian Palicki was Tony Walsh, and you might recognize her from John Wick and The Orville on television. Connor Cruz was Daryl Jenkins, and he was in 7 Pounds. Edwin Hodge was Danny, and he was in the Purge movies and Bumblebee.
Oh,
Yeah. Brett Cullen was Sergeant Tom Eckert, and he was in The Joker, Ghost Rider, Dark Knight Rises. He likes his comic book movies. Alyssa Diaz was Julie. She was regular on The Rookie on television. Julian Alcaraz was Greg. He was on Haywire, which was a pretty good action flick in its own right. Will Yoon Lee was Captain Chow. We talked about him in episode 84.
Total Recall. And yeah, the only connection you can find in this one.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. And he's been a regular on Altered Carbon as the original body. What's that character's name?
Oh, geez. I've rewatched both series and read the books, but I still can't remember his name.
Well, why am I asking you? You're terrible at holding names.
I am.
You were like the last guy I should have been asking. Jeffrey Dean Morgan was Sergeant Major Andrew Tanner. And you know him from The Walking Dead, The Losers, and Watchmen, the film.
I'm surprised he's never come up before.
Yeah, we've used him in casting quite a bit, but we've never actually talked about him.
Watch Dead and Breakfast. He's great at that.
You know, you bring that one up a lot. I'm almost sorry I lent that to you. You loved it way more than I did. Fernando Chien was Lieutenant Pack, and he was in, unfortunately, the Netflix Iron Fist, but he was also in Fast Five, which I can forgive because I love the Fast and Furious movies. Ken Choi was Smith, and he was a regular in Sons of Anarchy. And Matt Gerald was Hodges, and he was also in San Andreas and the Netflix Daredevil television series.
So that's better than
ours. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. No, one thing I was kind of wondering, and I couldn't really find an answer to this, so if somebody else out there even knows, I would be curious in finding out, how did any of the Chinese actors feel about being like reskinned as North Koreans after they were finished shooting this movie?
I don't know how they felt about it. They probably didn't feel too good about it, but at the same time, I get why the studio did that. China was becoming a big market, and to put them in a negative light would have kept that film out of the Chinese markets, which is why they reskinned them as North Korea.
Apparently it never did actually come out in China anyway.
Yeah, so all that work for nothing.
Yeah.
Well, I think the studio was also going, please don't hate us. And MGM was having financial issues, which is why this sat on the shelf for a couple of years. And, well, losing 15 to 20 million on this movie certainly didn't help their financial woes.
No. Yeah. I thought it was crazy that this movie came out in exactly the same time period when it was supposed to come out, bookends. When it actually came out, like in between is the other terrible John Milius remake of Conan the Barbarian. So there's just something going on where I feel like they were bad for similar reasons.
Yeah, there comes a point where it's kind of like you got to lean into the realism of some of this. You can't make it all shiny and pretty the whole time. It doesn't help. Sometimes you got to make it ugly.
Well, and yeah. One thing that one glaring difference between the two movies for me is how they made everything sort of happen in an urban environment. And that pulled you out of the isolation that the original characters felt.
Yeah,
because absolutely.
Everything was kind of remote and they were ambushing caravans and stuff like that out on the road. They very rarely went into town because it was too risky.
Yeah. They were in the mountains in the winter, cold as fuck.
Yes.
Like you could feel it and you'd be like, yeah, that would really be part of what's wearing you
down.
Oh,
yeah. That original shoot, they were like shooting in weather below zero. It was very cold. It was, I think, minus 13, 14 Celsius on days on those shoots. So, I mean, that's cold for Americans anyway. Not too cold for us.
I know. See,
a quote from C. Thomas Howell where he says, "It was so cold that Charlie Sheen and I had to spoon and pretend we liked each other."
Yeah, apparently Patrick Swayze got frostburn so bad that like basically up until the end of his life, anytime it got cold, he would feel like people were shoving toothpicks under his fingernails.
Yeah, you can get frostbite and it'll frickin' stick with you. And that like add windburn on top of that. Holy shit. But which brings me to kind of one thing about this movie that sort of irritated me is when they talk about how the Russians came across Alaska and just right through Canada, but then we stopped them at the Canadian border. I'm like, you don't think Canada would have done some shit? It made me mad.
Yeah, was a little bit annoyed by that too.
Yeah, because it's like, we're used to fighting in fucking cold. That's where we truly come to life.
Yeah, what happened to Canada in those like 5-10 years that Canada's military just went into the shitter?
Right? And it didn't even have to be their military. I mean, look at the Wolverines. I'm sure there would have been, growing up in a small town, there would have been a lot of little tiny Canadian Wolverines.
Yeah, I mean, Wolverines, like the comic character Wolverine is even from Canada.
Right?
This movie could easily have been a Canadian movie.
Oh, if Wolverine was on the Wolverines, this movie would have been a whole lot shorter.
Yeah.
It would have been more similar to the remake where you have Thor in the Wolverines.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't think your average Canadian is that hot all the time.
I just kept waiting for him to call the thunder down and be done with him. As ludicrous as having North Koreans invade the U.S.,
There was a lot of this movie where they were like, wouldn't it just be cool if instead of guerrilla war tactics, you just had these characters like look cool in a generic, I'm don't want to be caught by somebody and I'm hiding in plain sight, walking away from explosions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in this movie, like a lot of walking away from explosions in this movie. Way too much.
Well, in the original, you have Tony who comes in, drops off a bomb, but she's gone and fucked off well before that thing goes off.
Yes.
Yeah, no, she's walking away when it's blowing up. And I'm like, yeah, you're kind of tipping your hat, aren't you?
Right?
Oh, yeah. Like, they're all, like, so cool-headed in the remake. Like, they're just, like, they're not, none of them ever seem overly concerned about anything happening.
Yes.
There's never really any sense of jeopardy.
No, the only time that happens is when Matt abandons his post to go and rescue his girlfriend and ends up getting another one of the Wolverines killed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's that big argument between him and Jed about how irresponsible it was and sort of emphasizing the risk it takes when you don't follow the rules or follow instructions. But that was about the only moment of that.
Yeah.
And let alone right after that, Erica is a competent soldier.
Like immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody else has been training for months and she's suddenly going on missions.
Right.
Another thing that actually really bothered me about the remake. So in the original one, you have Patrick Swayze and he's like, oh, you know, my dad named me after this Civil War guy. And, you know, I read all of these books. And so, you know, you never fire twice because then they'll be able to find out where you are. And mm-hmm. They were conserving ammunition. And there's all of this whole aspect to it. And then in the remake, they have this like training montage where all of them are just firing automatic weapons everywhere and just shooting all the time.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous, especially because it's established not firing twice is a great reason in the original one because they're being actively looked for by mm-hmm. the Russians. And we're told they're being actively looked for in the new movie, but they have no qualms about just firing tons and tons of ammunition in the woods.
And the thing about the original, when he first mentions that, never shoot twice, they're hunting for food. It makes sense that they would actually take the chance on shooting something because they need to eat.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're not just randomly shooting just to shoot.
Like there is a scene where Chris Hemsworth, he's like shooting at a tree and the bullets go everywhere and he takes a couple steps forward and like, you know, uses the automatic weapon again, takes a couple steps forward, uses the automatic weapon again, hits the tree. And he's like, we got to get better weapons.
Well, making a point there because somebody said this is a cool gun. And he's like, no, this is garbage. And he was
spray and spray.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's completely counterintuitive to be firing a gun that often when you know that there's people looking for you.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, I may have missed this, but where did they get all of the tons and tons and tons of ammunition in the remake? Because they pretty well established where they got their weapons in the original one.
Well, I mean, they're picking up what's left over from the people they've killed. But yeah, they start out with quite a bit. At least in the original, like they stopped at a supply store and loaded up with as much as they could before heading into the mountains. It's pretty much right away in the remake that the Koreans know they're in the mountains. Like they have a snitch that says they're at the cabin. Thankfully, they were smart enough to get the fuck out when that guy left. But they know they're up in the mountains. They should have been scouring the mountains the whole time.
Yeah. Yep. And I do have to say that's one thing the remake did add that I liked was the collaborators. And they did it fairly early on. They have that one character who runs away, snitches them out, and then has that great end when the friendship center blows up,
mm-hmm.
where he's ratting them out again, and then all of a sudden he just gets enveloped by that explosion. I did like that.
But, you know, in the original, what I thought was the part where their friend Daryl was forced, like his dad turns him in and forced him to, like, swallow this tracker, and they're going to kill him. And it's like, this is their friend that they've known, and he mm-hmm. didn't really mean to betray them. He just got caught up. Like, that was heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was. And that's another spot where Robert's transitioned from being this sort of very soft, family oriented young man to being a pretty much a psychopathic killer.
Yeah.
Shows up where he just walks up and does him.
Well, and they tell him that when he kills his first deer and then gets blooded, they're like, you know, when you drink the blood, they say it changes you until the end of your days. Yeah, and when he first tastes the blood, he's like, you know, that wasn't so bad. It wasn't so bad. And yeah, then throughout the rest of the movie, yeah, he gets progressively more and more cold-hearted towards killing.
I kind of liked how they did that scene in the remake, although it's terrible, is they tell about this tradition and make him drink it, and they're like, no, we don't do that. That's disgusting. So yeah. So here's this big character moment, and they just treat it as like a joke. And that happens a lot in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, that was like, I was just like, fuck off when they did that. Like, it's just, I feel like people are afraid to make movies as earnest as the original Red Dawn today.
Yeah. Well, they're afraid to make characters that feel fear, are vulnerable. Like, I think it's like Chris Hemsworth. It's everybody, every average person has to be a fucking superhero, and they aren't. And it drives me fucking nuts. It's kind of like just these average people. Like, and you know what? I think it feeds a false narrative that really is just detrimental to society as a whole. You're like, oh, I'm an amazing, as soon as I got a gun, I'm an amazing superhero. No, you're not, doofus. You suck as a person, and just maybe get on with that.
Like, there is this great bit ages ago when I was listening to the X-Files podcast, which is now defunct, but it's still worth listening to.
Kumail Nanjiani.
Yeah. There's a bit where they talk about the episode Blood, where Mulder is by himself and he's fighting the vampires. And it's from season two, but he takes off his shirt and they're like, oh, you know, David Duchovny's a little chubby. But then they're like, wait a second, he's not. It's just people in movies now are so ripped, like Star-Lord. Yeah. He's a regular schlub dude, but he's like as ripped as an Asgardian god.
Yeah.
You know, tying it all back around Thor, this movie. But yeah, you're totally right. People are so ripped in movies now that people who are ripped like in the 90s, like look flubby by comparison.
Yes.
I wasn't born with a personal trainer.
No. And you know what? Here's the thing with that, all that, like too much. And this is just my opinion. I'm like, there's too much going on there. Just give a little paunch is kind of nice. I don't want all that toughness. You know, if I'm going to snuggle up to you, it's not going to be comfortable. I'm sorry. It just isn't.
Well, part of what makes John McClane work is he feels like an average dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, okay, you can have your Schwarzeneggers and your Stallones that are ripped, but guys like Bruce Willis.
Steps on glass, it hurts. When stuff happens, it hurts. He shows injury.
Yeah. I mean, he should have died 100 times in that movie, but yes, you feel for the guy because you feel like he's more like you.
Mm-hmm. You know, actually, in a microcosm, the very first Die Hard movie and the very last one basically show this degradation of believable action heroes in like modern movies, because in the first one he's super believable,
yeah,
and then in the last he's like ripped and he's a superhero.
Well, I'd even point out like Fast and the Furious, which, let's face it, even the first one was fairly unbelievable, and where it is now,
like it's a cartoon now,
it is a you're absolutely right, to the point they did make a cartoon for Netflix, but
nice.
But it really has changed action movies in that regard, and we kind of got away from the grittier action movie. Thankfully John Wick kind of brought it back, but I'd even say John Wick's getting a little guilty of falling into that trap as well.
It is The thing is, to me, when you do that, if you have a regular person and they're struggling, there's much richer opportunities for drama and character. And when you make them like invincible out the gate, I'm not as interested in their journey.
Yeah, exactly.
So have we just suddenly stumbled on the fact that superhero movies have ruined other action movies?
Yeah.
I don't think we've stumbled on that. I think that's a known fact.
We visited the park where they did this. That's not, we didn't stumble upon it. We drove there purposely.
I would say, so people in horror for a long time were making this argument that CGI ruined horror movies. And I feel like that's not necessarily the case. But I do feel like CGI is kind of ruined action movies. Because a lot of action movies, like all the best ones that come out today, are ones that you really like and get into because they have, you know, amazing stunt work with real people doing things. And the more that you add like fake computer rendered things to an action movie, the less you can get into it. It's part of the reason action movies are great. Like even a movie crazy like True Lies or like some, you know, James Cameron type action movies, they're over the top and they're crazy. And similar to a new Fast and Furious movie in True Lies, he rides a motorcycle off of a building and then lands on top of another building. But they still do a level of stunt work and there's a level of reality where you can suspend your disbelief. And you really can't do that with some movies like the modern Red Dawn.
Well, I think part of the problem too is, and I mean, this, I blame Michael Bay for this. I'm not going to apologize for blaming Michael Bay, is it stopped being about the characters and more about how many action scenes can I stuff into an hour and a half or 2 hours? So you don't care about the characters, and it's really hard to enjoy a movie when you don't give a shit about the people.
You know, it's, to me, it's very much, it's kind of like, and I don't think I'm being absurd by saying this, is it's like taking the template for porn and using it for action movies. Whereas porn, you have a teeny bit of story and then people are boning. And in the action movies, you have a teeny little bit of story and then you have to have an action set piece.
Yes.
You know, I've heard a similar comparison made where even in the 90s, people said that action movies were basically approached like musicals where you have your story beats. But the main differences, though, that I think you hit on is in porn, all of the sex scenes, they're there, but none of them actively contribute to what's happening. Whereas in musicals, the musical numbers do contribute to what's happening if they're good, as should be with a good action movie.
Yeah. And then they don't. They're just, we need to have something big happen here. Oh, we'll do this. And it's sort of like, you know, I've never seen this in an action sequence and I'll just put it in there. It doesn't matter that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Like you really didn't need to have that fighter jet be hit by a missile at the beginning of the remake.
Nope.
It's just like, yeah, here's a collection of actually John Milius. He, when he read the script for the remake before they made it, when it was still about China and everything, one criticism that he had of it was it was strange because the people who wrote it were obviously fans of the original, but the script was just a collection of things that they thought were neat. And they were like, I think that this is neat, so let's put this in. I think this is neat, so let's put this in, with not real any rhyme or reason. And that's exactly how it felt.
Yeah, because it feels like a clip show of here's some of the moments you really remember from the original, while still trying to steer it in a different way. Like, I like that moment of sacrifice of the brothers at the end going, you know, this is worn on them. They've been used up and they know they're going on a suicide mission to hopefully free some people. You don't get that sense at the ends where if they're used up, maybe it's time to hang it up and let the military come in. They pull off this mission and are offered a ride home. They're, forces decimated, it might be time to hang it up. Nah, we're still gonna fight because that's what we do. That's all they know. That's all they got left. And that might be a good story if we'd seen a little bit more of that during the film.
Yeah,
because the other thing in the original is that is the group of gorillas, the Wolverines, they grew and shrank and grew and shrank as they lost people and gained people.
Yeah.
I mean, they you never really got to know the new members, but because it was focused on the core group. But you did see them become a larger group, and then it slowly whittled down again. You don't see that in the remake at all. It's like you get that core group, they add Matt's girlfriend, and then you get three military guys instead of one, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. A few people get pegged along the way on this vital mission to extract this ridiculous piece of technology, and then they stay behind, and the next thing you know, they got an army again.
Yeah.
You could, I mean, you know, I'm sure time has passed and they were recruiting, but like, you know, this just doesn't have the same impact of trying so hard and the loss. It reduces the impact of the loss of the characters that you were supposed to be attached to.
Yeah. This movie really didn't need a MacGuffin. Like, in the original one, like, you don't really know what they can accomplish by fighting, but they have to fight because what's the alternative? They don't really have a concrete end game in the original one, but that's also kind of why it works because, yeah, like they can't give in to the Russians and be put in camps. All they can do is fight until they can't fight anymore.
There's some great dialogue there where Jed says, where somebody says, well, why, we're no better than them if we just go kill them. And he says, no, but we are different. They're just visiting.
Yeah.
We live here.
We live here. This is our home. Yeah. When it comes to the remake, I would like to introduce a term called dumbguffin, whereas it's something that is unnecessary as a MacGuffin and shouldn't be there, and it's stupid. So dumbguffin.
Yep. Please reference Ocean's 11. We did that episode too. I was also angry about the a very similar MacGuffin, a dumbguffin.
Yeah, a dumbguffin.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I like the original for the fact that this feels like, okay, this is this isolated town, a small military operation in a much bigger war. Like, the fact that this MacGuffin is going to change the act of the war, suddenly this town has become far more important because they have this technology that they could steal. Now, there's certain references to coding machines in World War II where, yes, that becomes a vital piece of equipment they want to get so they can listen in. And that was kind of the idea I think they were going for, but it was such a ridiculous one.
Yeah.
I know. And I mean, they could have had the obvious addition to their team would be somebody who speaks Korean, just like some kid who's there and his parents speak Korean.
I think that's why we never heard them talk in Korean, because it was originally shot to be Chinese and they had to cut out all the Chinese dialogue because they actually digitally changed the flags and stuff. They shot it as Chinese being the enemy. So I think there might have been some character stuff with the enemy, with the Koreans, that was completely cut because now you can't have Koreans speak in Chinese.
You can't defend the Chinese. It's really funny, though, where it's sort of like, you know, if you're going to do that, you might as well do what they did in World War II movies, where all the Germans speak English, but with a British accent. Just do that. They're Chinese, but they speak with a British accent.
What was that one from the early 2000s? I think it was it Behind Enemy Lines? It might have been something else. And it was all Americans as British people and all the British were the Russians.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is going on?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Just do that. Have fun with it. If you're going to be stupid, just do it stupid but fun.
That's actually another thing, too, with this remake. I feel like I didn't really know much about the original Red Dawn, other than it's a movie that some people really passionately like. But it's always been off my radar. And I, for some reason, didn't even know that it was a John Milius movie until we were watching it. Weirdly enough, we just watched Conan the Barbarian. It was Leah's first time watching it the night before. So nice. It was kind of a fun coincidence. But a lot of people really refer to the original Red Dawn as being like a cheesy movie with nerds. And even in my research, I see a lot of people refer to it that way. And I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's partially why the remake is not good, is because that's what they were going for. But that's really not why the original movie works. It's not because it's like a bit it's cheesy wish fulfillment with like good one-liners and or whatever. But that's like kind of what they were trying to do with the remake.
It's like they remade it off of the reviews, not from actually watching the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I find that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what you're watching, because, you know, I don't have high regard for the 84. I mean, I liked it, but I don't think I'd go back to watch it again. But cheesy is not one of the ways I would describe it.
No, when you look at this cast and their body of work at the time, I mean, these kids did serious movies. And in 1984, this was definitely serious. It's rose-colored glasses and the glasses of time, or however you want to put it. I mean, it doesn't stand up quite as well as it might, but it's some pretty serious subject matter in the end of things. It wasn't all Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink. I think that's what made it kind of unique at the time, is it did delve into some darker themes for what is essentially a Brat Pack type of
flick. And there's some decent performances from everybody in that movie.
Yeah, and this is like just a little before the next wave of war movies like Full Metal Jacket and Platoon. I mean, Platoon was Charlie Sheen. It would only be like, a year or two later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charlie Sheen just kept showing up in those movies.
Yeah.
Do we have a military movie? Do we have Charlie Sheen? Okay.
His star climbed pretty quickly. I guess originally Red Dawn for the Jed character, it was supposed to be Emilio Estevez.
Ooh. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And that's like some interesting stunt casting.
Yeah. Which does make you think, I'm like, oof, that could have wound up being the military version of Breakfast Club if that had gone that way.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I would have minded at all, but it does make you wonder. I'm like, oh, this might have been a very different movie just with that casting as your lead instead of Patrick Swayze.
And honestly, if you're going to do that, what you need to do is put Martin Sheen as the dad instead of Harry Dean Stanton. Just fill it out with all of the right people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You might as well just do the Sheen clan.
Yeah. I mean, Martin was in Apocalypse Now. So,
yeah.
Yeah, you watch that movie and he looks like Charlie does in Platoon. Like they're mm-hmm. so close in age. It's like, wow, you guys look very similar.
Oh, yeah. Well, Charlie Sheen's voice in this movie sounds a lot like Emilio Estevez when he was younger.
Yeah. Well, do you remember, what was it, the parody movies that Charlie Sheen did, yeah, kind Shots. Of playing on his character, Hot Shots? And then they pass, like it's him and Martin Sheen passing, like, I loved you in Wall Street.
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the blatant product placement in the remake.
Oh, yes, I caught that, the subway scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you missed that.
Yeah. That was, I think, supposed to be a reference because in the original, if you watch the trailer, which you're not going to get a sense of in the audio I played, you see the Russians pulling up to a McDonald's and some chaos happening there. Now, that's all been cut from the film, so you can only see it in the trailer. And I think that was pulled because there was some mass shooting at a McDonald's a few months earlier back in the 80s. And yeah, they wound up putting a similar scene where they had just done a military action. They ducked into a subway and pretty much robbed of its food while they were hiding. I'm like, yeah, you know, these are supposed to be your people. Maybe you shouldn't have held the guns at them while you're just taking their bread.
What's funny is you're like, okay, so there was a shootout at McDonald's, so we'll take that out. Now this one goes to a subway where the spokesperson is a sexual predator. It just, it'd be funny if it was a domino effect where they shot like basically every fast food joint until everything just, they ran out. They had to invent one.
Well, if it's that kind of press, then we can maybe get away from fucking product placement.
Yeah.
I mean, they hold up the subway and then you have a scene where they're all just like enjoying their subs and they're like, what do you miss most? Oh, I think I miss Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare.
Yeah. Oh,
God.
Right?
They were living it.
And yeah, here's the dumb part. It's like it's that type of shit where people are like, well, I know exactly how to be a guerrilla warfare because I played Call of Duty. No, it's a video game.
Hey, I saw one reviewer of the remake and they're like, even if all of the young people would be crack shots and good at shooting because they're the Xbox generation. It's like, no, that's not how that works.
No joystick on guns.
I am much better with a gun. I suck on a video game. Like, Sam's probably the same as me. You give Sam a rifle, he's probably pretty good. But
I've never fired a gun in my life.
Really?
Really?
Farm never kid. Had it in my hand. Ah, not even at Gophers. Nope. Okay.
Yeah, I grew up in, well, when I was a teenager, I lived in rural Saskatchewan. So, like, everybody had guns over there. I went out shooting targets and stuff pretty regularly.
We had to do Gophers because they were everywhere on the farm. And it was like, you didn't want anything breaking its leg because of those Gophers.
Yeah.
And my dad was a trap shooting champ, so there was that.
I was firing a rickety old gun one time, and when I fired it, it like split apart, and that was terrifying.
Oh,
like, it exploded in three pieces.
Oh, that would be awful. That would be terrifying. That would be part of a movie. That would be like they only had access. See, if they had part of this where they only had access to like some guns that they just found, that would be an amazing part where they're like, oh, God.
Yeah, like swing by the farmhouse and he's like, "Don't we don't have much, but we have like some of these old guns." And
yeah,
that was actually another thing I loved when they went to that, you know, those people's houses who are like secretly harboring them. And then they're hiding their granddaughters in the basement and have to send them along their way.
Yeah.
A lot of this movie felt real.
Yeah. This goes back to your argument about the French Resistance. That's exactly what happened in the French Resistance, right? Is you had the sort of the quiet sympathizers helping the resistance. And that's exactly what happened in this movie. They borrowed an awful lot from that exact real life scenario.
Yeah,
and they would pull out those sympathizers and execute them to try to draw out the Wolverines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which when the Russian comes by, he makes a really good point. Do you slaughter your pig because it saw the fox take the chicken? No, you don't. It's dumb. We're no more reprisals starting from now. And I'm like, okay. He actually knows what he's kind of doing. Everybody else is sort of fucking up royally.
Yeah. You know, it was a little ridiculous in the remake when they're watching with the binoculars early on. And then the sheriff, like the North Korean commander is like talking to them through the speaker horn. And the sheriff gets the megaphone. And then he's like, I want you to fight them with all of your might, you know, get these guys. And then they wait till he's finished his speech before they decide to stop him.
Right?
Yeah. And they were big on execution. Because remember, they were going to execute the shop owner where Matt and his girlfriend got their clothes for their escape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was the only time in the remake they did that.
Yeah. And ironically, it's like, how do they find that particular store owner? Because they established that this is a city of 500,000 people.
Yeah. I know. Like, and they somehow went through every store and managed to find the one orange jumpsuit, which she could have easily disposed of.
Well, that one actually didn't bother me too much because it would have been, they would have started with the stores closest to whatever that military action was and then scoured the neighborhood and then they found the evidence. I mean, that all makes sense. You just didn't see it on screen.
Yeah, I think the big flaw was as Trish said, is why do you keep something that's clearly evidence in your store to be found? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was silly. They would have had to have caught up to her pretty quickly if that was the case. And it looked like they had already set up a new operation because they managed to save her.
Yes.
And at the very least, honestly, if I'm getting that stuff, all you have to do is put it in some bleach or like dye it. It's going to be like 5 minutes. What are they going to say? Be like, yeah, no, I just got it. And this is like a new pair of pants.
I feel like the remake really throws logic out the window for most things.
Yes.
Almost everything. Yeah.
Absolutely. Anything and everything. They're like, oh, is this the most logical thing we could do in the script right now? No. Good. Let's do it.
I feel like with the original one, you can tell that there was, I mean, you know, we already talked about how there's elements of it that are unrealistic, obviously, but you can tell that there's a lot of thought and consideration into everything that does happen. And you can tell that there was no thought or consideration into a lot of things with this remake.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had a time limit and they're like, okay, what things do we want to pull from the original film? And oh shit, mm-hmm. do we have any ideas left for the last 10 minutes?
Right?
Like, the ending of the remake was just, it's a non-ending.
It is a non-ending. Yep. Yeah. Well, I mean, when they deviate in that third act to go find some stupid MacGuffin, I mean, that's the dumb guffin. That's when it all goes out the window. You're like, yeah, this is going to be not nearly as poignant as the ending of the original. They couldn't have gotten further away from it. They wanted a happier ending.
My brain completely tuned out almost at that point.
Same.
I had to definitely try to focus on the movie at that point.
Especially when, having Jed, was it Jed? Yeah, who was shot in the head right near the end of the movie. They thought they were home free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was a bit out of left field because I thought we were near the end, but, it was pointless because he didn't die on a mission. They got sniped because of a tracker.
Yeah.
Yeah. It completely undoes everything he does, essentially. It's very, like, at least in the original, his death was a sacrifice and it meant something.
Yeah. This one meant nothing.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that's how deaths happen in war.
Yeah.
You don't always die a hero. That was about the only surprise. And I wouldn't say it was a good one, but it just kind of wasted what little drama was there.
Yeah.
Honestly had to rewatch the last 10 minutes of the movie because I was kind of similar to Trish. Like I was tuned out a little bit and I looked down for a few minutes, probably looking up something having to do with the movie or something for the podcast. And I look up and it cuts to credits. And I was like, wait, what just happened? Did this movie end? And no, it didn't. It just kind of stops.
You're looking at something more interesting. So that's what happened. Like, it's weird. Like, it looks like they were trying to do the thing where they're like, war can be like a pointless exercise, but completely fucked it up. Like, the original ending, it's like he's used up. Everything is done. It's not for nothing, but it also isn't for everything. Like, it's sort of the other guy kind of is just tired. He's like, yeah, just go. It gives us something, at least at the end, to feel.
I felt like the ending almost was like, let's start a franchise for something. Mm-hmm. With them rescuing all the people in the internment camp and stuff like that is like, and then how they're growing their little army of guerrillas and so on. And it fell really flat for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just that open-endedness that we could do a sequel or maybe a television series but at the end, not so great. Well, let's wrap this up with a few stats here. Red Dawn on IMDb, the 84, rates a 6.4 out of 10. And the remake is only a point down, 5.4 out of 10, but we can really see the difference in the Rotten Tomatoes. Anybody want to guess on the critic score for the 84?
36.
Yeah,
you know, I feel like it's much lower than it should be because I really liked it a lot. I think it's a, it was actually a much better movie than I'd ever thought. I'm
doing 36 on 2012. Is that wrong?
Oh, okay. No, we're doing the 84 right now. We'll save you 36.
Okay.
What's the 84?
62.
62 for critic. Okay.
Yeah, I would have to say maybe like 60 or 50. I'd say 55 is probably the critic score for the original one. And then for the new one, maybe 37.
Okay. So, Sam?
I'm passing on the original because I'm pretty sure I saw it.
Okay.
But
I was like above 50.
Yeah, and it's I don't remember seeing it above 50. I think I saw it.
Okay.
For the remake, I'd probably say like 28%.
Okay. So critics gave the original, and I can understand this, like, because it's a weird little movie. They gave it a 46%. So critics weren't too kind to the original. Audience liked it a little bit more at 65%.
So I was audience close.
Yeah. The budget of the movie was $17 million, and it went on to make $38 and change. So it was a fairly successful movie. I wouldn't call it a blockbuster, but, you know, when you double your money, at least in the 80s, you don't have to make as much. So you did all right. Now, we've already established that they lost $15 million on their $65 million budget on the 2012, but the critic score, and it looks like everybody, the highest one we had was 36%.
36.
Jeff was around the same, and Sam was even harsher on it.
Yeah.
But the critics liked it even less than that. 15% of critics.
Oh, I can see it.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
It was a terrible movie.
Yeah. And 51% audience score. So audiences were far more forgiving. But yeah, critics hated it. And I can see why. We stumbled upon very similar things during our conversation tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's to the point where, like, if MGM hadn't gone bankrupt, I would be trying to get my money back for the $5 rental.
When you think about it, too, like, poor Chris Hemsworth, outside of the Thor movies, kept having movies sitting on the shelves. Cabin in the Woods took forever to come out.
And that's a really good movie.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that one. He's good in that one.
That was another. I mean, the timing wound up working out because, you know, you had Joss Whedon and then that one dropped right around the Avengers. So, you know, Chris Hemsworth was making a name for himself and then Whedon was doing the Avengers and he produced Cabin in the Woods. So it kind of worked out, but the sitting on it. But I don't think that was all intentional at the time.
The thing about like the remake too is it's one of those things where, you know how they have people who are way too old to be playing young people? Sometimes I just want to do a parody movie where all of us are playing 20 somethings because it's that ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, except
especially
Jeff
contrasted
can
with the, like with the original one, like they are all legitimately teenagers. And then in the new one, like they're all very obviously in their 20s.
Yeah.
Late 20s.
So strange. Like they have such a good template. I feel like Red Dawn isn't a movie that would be impossible to remake today if you did it the right way, and they just did it the complete wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they have talented young actors. This is what bothers me the most, is there's actors that are good, that are young, and you just don't use them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it for Red Dawn. Thank you, Esten, for making that recommendation and your interactions with us. We're always happy to look at a request, and if you would like to maybe see an episode you want us to cover, your movie that you want us to fantasy remake or a comparison that you want us to do, follow us on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com. And in any of those places, you can let us know and send us your requests. It always helps if you tell us where to find it. I mean, we are in Canada. It's going to be different in the States where a lot of our audience is. But help us out and see if we can help us track down the movies you want us to do. It will up your shot at seeing your episode done. And again, we don't want anything post-2000, so it's got to be before the year 2000. I won't even consider anything after that. And try to make it interesting. Like, if it's a great movie already that you just didn't quite like, well, that's on you. We're not going to remake an already great movie or a pretty damn good one. So
we're not going to remake Jaws.
No.
No. Just think of it like you're watching something and most of it is bad, but there's that shining little pearl that you're like, ooh, if they just did something with this, it would be wonderful. That's how you should look at it. You're looking for a movie with a tiny pearl in it, not a giant movie with a lot of stuff, but a few problems. Like, just flip those.
Exactly, because we need shit to talk about. If it's already a good movie, it's going to be a lot harder to talk about. And then, mm-hmm. then it'll wind up being our One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest episode where I'm just going to have to make some shit up.
Yeah, where we're going to talk about how good it was and have no idea how to do anything with it.
Yeah.
That was so traumatic.
If you are going to recommend a good movie, it has to be a good movie that like most people have never heard of for some reason or another.
Yeah, well, or something that could be updated.
We've done that too. We stumbled across a couple of movies now where like, well, shit, that was really good. How do we make this better? So it happens. Yeah. Well, and also visit our website and tell your friends about where to find us. And you can do that by directing to the website. And there are tons of links to all sorts of podcast providers. Sam, what is the Wix site?
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And on that site is a button and then it says store, and that'll take you to our TeePublic store. We got tons of wonderful designs there, and every sale gets a little cut to us, and all of that goes back into the production of the show. So wear some cool digs on your back, on your front. Drink out of a mug, wear a PPE mask, all sorts of cool stuff there. So check it out, TeePublic, and you can get there quickly by the link on our Wix site.
Yeah, you can get notebooks where you can write down all the wonderful ideas you have for fan challenges. That's a possibility.
And you can get unruled notebooks so you can sketch your favorite characters from the movies we've been talking about.
Ooh, you can design a Dumb Guffin t-shirt.
No, they can't do it. We're going to do that. Coming next. Okay, guys. Well, I think that's it for Red Dawn. The invasion is over for this week, but we'll be back next week with another fan challenge. Until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
And I always return as Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
Never saw the brothers again. In time, this war, like every other war, ended. But I never forgot, and I come to this place often, though no one else does. In the early days of World War III, guerrillas, mostly children, placed the names of their lost upon this rock. They fought here alone and gave up their lives, so that this nation shall not perish from the earth.